Welcome to episode 36 of Primary Care Update. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell, a family physician, professor at the University of Georgia, and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence, an evidence-based online primary care reference from Wiley Blackwell. Check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any particular product. Joining me again this week, Dr. Henry Berry, family physician and one of the founders of POEMS, and Dr. John Hickner, editor of the Journal of Family Practice. Henry, how are you?
I'm doing well. I was just thinking here about all of the opportunities that people have for outdoor play at this time of year. There are fewer opportunities, and thinking about some of our more vegetative indoor activities. So, you know, this is a good time of year for reading books and indoor hobbies. Mark, I know you build airplanes and I collect stamps. John, what do you do during the winter?
I go outside and cross-country ski.
How's the guitar work going?
Oh, very good. Yes. Getting better by the month, not by the day.
So we're all nerds, as you can tell, and we're going to nerd out about 10 poems today. So this is a little bit different than our usual podcast. So as you may know, every month, the editors of Poems review over 100 journals to find 20 or so studies that primary care clinicians should know about because they have the potential to change and improve their care of patients. That's over 250 poems a year that get emailed to subscribers one at a time. The Canadian Medical Association, unlike the AAFP, I might add, has purchased a subscription for all of its members. Those members can vote on the relevance of each poem to their practice using a validated tool. Actually, about 1,500, sometimes up to 2,000 vote on each poem. And at the end of the year, my friend Roland Grad, who's on the faculty at McGill University in Montreal, compiles a top 20 poems list based on the ones that are most relevant and most likely to change practice. So today we're going to cover the first 10 in that list. Note that these aren't in any particular order, but we have grouped them by topic. And we're going to start off with John talking about a couple of hypertension-related poems.
These two poems are about studies that are definite practice changers, so listen closely. The first answers the question, does bedtime ingestion instead of morning ingestion of hypertension medications produce better cardiovascular disease risk reduction in adults with hypertension? This has been suggested in the past. This is a large trial of nearly 20,000 adults, a very good randomized trial in which patients were randomized either to take all their blood pressure medicines at night or in the morning. And they followed outcomes, cardiovascular outcomes, MI, revascularization, et cetera, up to 6.3 years. The outcomes were much better in patients who took their medication at night. In fact, the number needed to treat to prevent one major cardiovascular outcome was 20. So the bottom line is very clear. There is a significant reduction in mortality and morbidity among patients who take their once daily antihypertensive medications at bedtime instead of on awakening, period. Tell all of your patients.
Yeah, this is a huge practice changer. We talked about it previously on this podcast, and I'll add that it was the number one, it was a single out of 250 poems, the one most highly rated by the Canadian Medical Association physicians for relevance and for practice changiness, I guess you would call it. So yeah, this is an important one. Best of all, it's free, and it's something we can start doing with our patients right now. I think you had another hypertension poem?
Yes, the next poem is about taking blood pressure, and this is a meta-analysis of taking fully automated blood pressures in the office rather than using a manual sphygmomanometer. The authors found 31 studies that studied this issue, nearly 10,000 participants. The gold standard was the automated ambulatory blood pressure recording during awake hours. And the automated blood pressure in the office had to use 3 to 5 readings separated by 1 to 2 minute intervals. When you compared the average blood pressures using the automated machine in the office, it was virtually the same as the ambulatory automated recordings, whereas taking it with the sphygmomanometer, it was as much as 14 millimeters higher systolic. The bottom line, once again, is clear that taking blood pressures in the office in patients with hypertension or to diagnose hypertension, you should be using one of the automated machines that takes repeated blood pressure. And by the way, the recent guidelines from the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association are based on automated readings. So if you're going to follow those guidelines, be sure that you use an automated cuff. Otherwise, you're going to be measuring blood pressures that are higher than they actually are.
Henry, any comments?
Yeah, so this is one that will require an investment on the part of office practices. I just did some quick snooping online to see how much these units cost. And for every single one of them, the website says, call for pricing. So there is a recurring theme, though, of this being an expensive investment or potentially expensive, and the discordance between office and home readings. And there was just a recent paper, I believe, in the Archives of Family Medicine that really looked at trying to incorporate how we incorporate the home readings into the office readings as another way of modifying the total blood pressure load on a patient.
Thanks, Henry. We're going to move on to behavioral medicine poems, and I think you had three in your group, so why don't we get us started?
Yeah, so the first one asks, which medications are effective in treating patients with generalized anxiety disorder, published in Lancet. These authors searched a ton of databases and registries, ultimately found 89 studies with more than 25,000 patients and 22 different drugs, multiple drug classes. They had enough data to actually do a network meta-analysis to estimate the relative comparative effectiveness of each drug, as well as its tolerability. Now, some of the limitations of the included studies was that none of them lasted for more than 6 months. Most of them were about 6 to 8 weeks in duration. There was some overlap in terms of the level of precision, but generally speaking, the drugs that had the best combination of effectiveness and tolerability in patients with that generalized anxiety disorder were duloxetine, pregabalin, venlafaxine, and escitalopram. There were some other drugs like quetiapine, paroxetine, and the benzodiazepines that were effective but poorly tolerated. Now, the dweeby part of me just want to point out that when they use symptom scores, while these were all better, none of the effect sizes appear to reach a threshold of being clinically meaningful.
John, comments?
Yes, I think the lesson for us as clinicians is that we should not rely totally on medications to treat anxiety. These folks need attention. They need behavioral therapy, or they certainly need counseling from us during office visits. So don't rely on the medications to entirely care for anxiety.
Yeah, cognitive behavioral therapy is really the first line treatment. And this, I consider medications like this to be, you know, almost an adjunctive kind of therapy to the CBT. If you can get that for your patients, I think that's, you know, I agree, clearly the best approach. And also they had a long list of medications, and it was, I did find it interesting, duloxetine, the pregabalin was up there as one of the most effective. So network meta-analyses are where they are comparing apples to oranges sometimes, and occasionally you get a bit of a flaky result. And so, you know, I probably would still go with duloxetine or venlafaxine over the pregabalin, but interesting finding.
I would have thought you would get juicy results rather than flaky results.
So how often do patients fail to disclose their symptoms during a visit to their primary care physician?
Yeah, this was a really provocative study that was published in Family Practice. They identified 190 adults who were scheduled to see their English general practitioner. They were videotaped, and each patient was asked, what was the main reason for the visit, and did they have any of 11 groups of symptoms that were in a checklist, and whether they planned to address those. What they found was during the office visit, intention and what they actually did were fairly discordant. Among the 139 who identified the intention to discuss at least one symptom from that checklist, only about a third I'm sorry, a third failed to disclose some of those symptoms. And the ones that were most common were fatigue, sleep problems, and intimate or personal problems. So what this tells us is that patients often fail to share some symptoms, especially things that are sensitive and particularly worrisome to them around their personal lives. So as primary care clinicians, we need to be aware about this. We need to look for cues and maybe develop some mechanisms and interaction styles that actually invite and give permission to have people share their concerns. Things simple as, what else would you like to speak with us about today? As opposed to, do you have anything else, which is a yes, no, leave those inquiries open-ended.
Yeah, this was a really nice study and a little bit different from the usual kind of poems, but I think it's important as we reflect on our practice. And certainly when you're having a busy day and you got a waiting room full of patients and you're running behind, sometimes the last thing you want to do is open the door to a potentially complex issue, but these are important issues too for our patients. I wonder if, you know, the fact that they were being asked a survey or a checklist or a patient portal type setting, that made them more willing to disclose. And maybe if we are using those, we should design them to make sure we ask about these kind of symptoms in particular, because they are so often undisclosed. Henry, I think you had one more for us.
Yeah, so this one was from the British Journal of Psychiatry. Now, one of the things we don't really emphasize all that often is the large number of different journals. It's not just 10 journals that we review and get really important information. We really comb the world's literature for our readers and listeners. This was a meta-analysis, and they looked at the individual data from 30 studies, really looking to see, does early symptom improvement, how is that associated with long-term outcomes of depression treatment, specifically failure? So they had about 2,200 patients that had received a placebo and about 6,000 that received an antidepressant. It turns out that about a third of the patients who did not have any of those early improvement symptoms within the first 2 weeks actually had improved, and that nearly half of those were considered to be much better by the time 12 weeks rolls around. So the bottom line on this one, and John, I think you did the original one on one of our podcasts, was that we shouldn't be in a hurry to change treatment in patients with severe depression who don't respond in those first couple of weeks.
And see the patient back soon, follow up soon, either by having your nurse give the patient a call in a week or two, but you should definitely see these patients back in 2 weeks in the office to make adjustments and provide encouragement if a patient is not yet responding.
Yeah, and of course, remembering that the combination, and there have been good primary care studies showing the combination of medication and cognitive behavioral therapy is better than either one alone. That's also good to remember. I guess I'm up next. So we got five cardiovascular poems. So we're going to hit a couple first on lipids, and then the last three we'll do as a group on aspirin. So the first one was by Mora and colleagues in JAMA Internal Medicine, and they looked at 8,270 adults with cholesterol less than 250, and they obtained non-fasting and fasting lipid levels about a month apart during the beginning of this clinical trial. What they found was there was actually little difference between total cholesterol, LDL, and HDL cholesterol between the two groups. The triglycerides were about 25 milligrams per deciliter higher in the non-fasting patients, but, you know, that's kind of a who cares, no big deal thing to me. I really only am interested in triglycerides for primary prevention if they're over 500, and even for secondary prevention of people with known heart disease. There's, you know, the data other than this one new drug with that very expensive synthetic omega-3 showed no benefit to treating triglycerides. So they're a good risk factor. They're a bad treatment target. In any case, so don't sweat the triglycerides so much. Basically, if whether someone has triglycerides of 150 or 175 isn't going to move the needle on treatment for me. And non-fasting lipids were actually at least as good a predictor of future cardiovascular events. And obviously it's easier. So John, should we still be telling our patients to fast? Are you comfortable with this?
Very comfortable with it. This is not the first study that has shown this to be the case. I think I started doing this about 10 years ago. It's just that it takes a long time for word to get out, but no need for fasting anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I've had family members who saw a physician recently and were, exactly the scenario, and they were getting lipids and they were sent away from the lab because they admitted that they'd had a cup of black coffee in the morning, and they were sent back. So maybe it's time to just educate the labs as well, because they often have very outdated protocols around fasting. Okay, so Henry, did you have a comment about the triglycerides too?
Yeah, well, the question of whether or not there's anything that requires fasting at all was actually the subject of the quiz in our very first podcast. So unless you really need to know triglycerides, or that you really want to inconvenience and annoy those patients, there's really no reason to routinely do fasting labs. Now, there may be a few special tests like cortisol levels or something like that, but certainly not the routine things that we order in primary care.
Sounds good. And we need to, everybody does not need a lipid profile every year. Everybody does not need a CMP every year. We need to be kind of thoughtful. Why are we ordering this? Is it because patient's on a medication? We want to monitor renal function. Is it just because we've always done it that way? So think then order. The next poem is from the Cholesterol Treatment Trialist Collaboration, and it's called Efficacy and Safety of Statin Therapy in Older People, a meta-analysis of individual participant data from 28 randomized trials, and it was published in The Lancet. So this, meta-analyses typically take the published data and combine those data. This is an individual-level meta-analysis where they got together with the researchers and they all pooled their data, sent all of their database files to a single repository, and then combined them. So there were 27 studies, 186,000 patients. They published a lot of work from this repository. In this case, they were looking at the 14,000 or so who were 75 and older and were followed for a median of 5 years. So we're focusing only on the older patients here. So for all older patients, statins reduced the risk of a non-fatal MI or a coronary death from 3% to 2.6% per year. So that's a number needed to treat of 250 per year, or 50 over a 5-year period. There was no effect on revascularization, stroke, and they found no effect in patients with pre-existing heart disease. Without pre-existing heart disease. So primary prevention in this group, they didn't see a benefit, only for those who already had heart disease. Henry, you wrote this poem, so I'll give you a whack at the comments here.
Yeah, so this is really similar to our other patients, that statins for primary prevention just is really a disappointment. Now, one might wonder what proportion of the elderly really are in that primary prevention arm. So I went back to the original paper, and it turns out that 45%, almost half, had no prior history of vascular disease, which was a rate very similar to the younger patients in those included studies. So the authors commented that, we just don't have enough data. I think you've got over 7,000 patients, or almost 7,000 patients in 5 years of follow-up. I think the data are reasonably robust, and that doing further study would be pointless.
Yeah, and that's a group that has a fairly high event rate. If you were following 40-year-olds and looking for cardiovascular events, you might need a much larger population or follow for a longer time. But in 75 and older, unfortunately, those folks are having events at a rate of, 3% a year or so. So you have the statistical power, I think, to find a difference if there was one. All right, so moving on, we're going to move on to aspirin. That's the last grouping of studies. The next three poems all look at low-dose aspirin. They all used 100 milligram dose for primary prevention. Two of the studies are reports from Dr. McNeil and the ASPREE investigator group, ASPREE. And the third, and those were published in the New England Journal, and the third is from the ASCEND study collaborative group, also published in the New England Journal. They were a little different in terms of their populations. The intervention was the same, and they were all primary prevention. So let me just talk through these. So both studies randomized patients without known vascular disease to aspirin or placebo, and they followed them for 5 to 7 years. The ASPREE trial recruited 19,000 older adults, 70 and older, in the U.S. and Australia, and found no difference between groups in the composite of cardiovascular death, non-fatal MI, stroke, hospitalization for heart failure, or any of the individual outcomes. The second Esprit study was looking at the same group, same data, but looked at different set of outcomes. They found no difference between groups in a composite of death, dementia, or disability, or in any of the individual outcomes. The Ascend trial, which is the second one in this group, recruited over 15,000 adults 40 and older with diabetes, but no known vascular disease. In this group, they found no difference between groups regarding all-cause or cardiovascular mortality, no difference in the primary composite of cardiovascular death, non-fatal MI or stroke, and not surprisingly, in both studies, major bleeding events were more common in the aspirin group. So this is something I got very interested in when we had this cluster of poems come out, and I happened to be next in the office next to me was a guy named Frank Moriarty, Dr. Moriarty from the Royal College of Surgeons. He's a pharmacologist and faculty member, and he was interested in it too. So we ended up doing a systematic review that's currently in press with the journal Family Practice from Oxford. It's a European primary care journal. And so we did a meta-analysis, and we compared aspirin trials that recruited patients between 1978 and 2002 with four large new trials that recruited patients since 2005. Our hypothesis, our observation informally was they didn't look as impressive the more recent studies. So the newer studies found fewer cardiovascular benefits, and they found no reduction in cancer incidence or mortality with aspirin. The older studies had shown pretty convincingly a reduction in colorectal cancer incidence and mortality, but when you looked at the new studies, wasn't there any longer. In fact, in one of the studies, there was an increase in cancer death rates. Based on the data from the four most recent studies, which had 60,000 patients, we calculate that for every 1,200 patients taking aspirin instead of placebo for 5 years, you're going to have four fewer major cardiovascular events, three fewer ischemic strokes, but eight more major hemorrhages and three more intracranial hemorrhages. So as we, you know, I think what's going on here is that as we do a better job of managing hypertension with less people smoking, with more people, pretty much half the population on statins, high rates of colorectal cancer screening. So we're reducing the risk, you know, the ability for cancer to be incidence or cause death. I think there's just less left for aspirin to do. And so now the benefits are smaller, the harms remain the same. So, John, should we be still considering primary prevention, aspirin for primary prevention in any of our patients?
No, I don't think so. This is very difficult for the lay public to understand when we have strong recommendations that change over time. And so I think the public adapts to this slowly. We think about the same thing in a way with screening for cervical cancer in women who now don't need to go get screening, but every 3 to 5 years. And that's been difficult for many women who've been accustomed to that. So I think it'll take a while for both doctors and the public to adopt this new practice of no aspirin.
Yeah, I think if you look at the guidelines, the European Society of Cardiology, they recommend against, just flat out recommend against it. If you look at the USPSDF, which was done before all of these new studies, all but one of them were published, says, you know, high risk adults should consider it. But that was based on almost exclusively these older studies. And these three newer ones, the Aspire, Esprit, and Ascend trials, hadn't been published yet. The Japanese prevention trial had been published, but, you know, people were saying, well, that's a different population, different demographic. Maybe it's different there. I don't, you know. And so because that trial didn't find any benefit to aspirin. But I think now it's pretty convincing. I don't know what the USPSDF is going to recommend next, but it wouldn't surprise me to see them scale back a little bit on that recommendation. And then the American Heart Association, they just published an updated guideline, and they've pulled back and are saying, you know, consider it for high-risk patients, but not for certainly for all patients, you know, routinely for primary prevention. So, yeah, I agree with you. I'm not recommending it anymore for patients. And we have two of these large studies with both diabetic and non-diabetic populations.
Well, that's it for this week. Those were 10 of the top 20 poems of 2019. Tune in for our next episode where we'll cover the other 10, and then we'll get back to our regular format. Please let your friends know about us. Rate us on iTunes. Let the world know about us on Twitter and Facebook, and we'll talk to you soon.